This is KSQD Santa Cruz. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
My guest is actress Haley Mills. An actress since she was a teenager, Haley Mills starred in Pollyanna and The Parent Trap and That Darn Cat and many other films that we love. She grew up on screen and continued to act in films and stage and television, and she has written a wonderful memoir called Forever Young. Haley Mills, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's a pleasure to be with you and all your listeners.
The title of your book, Forever Young, you know, I was thinking about this. Most of us, we have photos that remind us of our youth, maybe a few, and we have our memories, but you actually are forever young. That is, The Parent Trap, it's still there. It's still alive. Pollyanna, it's still there. And there you are, forever young.
Well, it's Dylan's song that captured me, really, Forever Young. He wrote it, I think, for his child. And it's such a lovely, lovely idea, that, which is so true, that however old we get, we're still the child. There's a part of us that is still the child that doesn't actually look anything like as decrepit as the outside. And and so I thought, you know, that was the real attraction for me. And yeah, of course, those movies, I guess I'm, you know, if I'm remembered at all, I'm remembered for those movies, those early movies, those Disney movies.
Yeah. Well, I'd never seen Tiger Bay before. I just watched it after reading your book. And wow, that is a marvelous film. And you're so natural and great in it. And it's impossible to know how old you are in it. You could have been, I know that you were 12 or 13 when you made it, but you could have been 9 or 16. It's hard to know.
I was 12, just 12. And that was the first film I ever made. And it was with my father, John Mills. And it was directed by J. Lee Thompson, who was a wonderful director and very, very good with children. And this German film star called Horst Buchholz, who I fell in love with. And it survived because it's beautifully made, and also because it is a little piece of history. It is very, you know, that's Tiger Bay as it was when we shot it, when we shot the film in 1958. And shortly after that, the docks, where it was shot in Cardiff, the docks were all those wonderful Victorian tenement buildings were all pulled down, and big apartment blocks were built up. So that community went forever, and so it is a little bit of history. And it was unusual for filmmakers to use real locations. And also the children in the film were all local children. And that wasn't done very often. So there was a great feeling of realism about that little movie.
Including that little girl. I mean, she's very real. She's not like what you would think of it as a film heroine. I mean, she's a liar and she's a thief.
Right. She's a survivor. I mean, I'm not saying these are great qualities, lying and thieving, but she was, you know, she's an orphan brought up by her darling auntie, who loves her but doesn't really know where she is half the time. And it was a marvellous part. It was such fun being that naughty, lying little thief.
I love it. And it's still a great movie. I have to show you something. My listeners can't see it, but you can. I've held on to this for many, many years. Can you see?
Oh, my goodness me.
It's a record. It's a 45 RPM record.
Jeepers Creepers and Johnny Jingo. Oh my God, they haunt me.
It's a beautiful, beautiful. You look fantastic on the cover. And you've written me a little letter, which I've treasured on the back.
Right, yes. To you personally.
Yes. Did you, is this anything like your handwriting, or did somebody at Disney do this?
No, that's not my handwriting. My handwriting wasn't so good as that, I'm afraid. When I wrote letters to Walt Disney, the secretaries at the studio had to type them out because my writing was so awful. He couldn't read.
One of the things you've talked about in your book is the people that wrote the music in your films. Because sometimes the scores are really great. Like a Tiger Bay score was written by Laurie Johnson, who did the theme for the Avengers. I loved the music in it.
Yes, yes.
And you made a movie with a Paul McCartney score, The Family Way.
The Family Way, yes. Yes, my goodness. When you're lucky enough to get a really talented composer, they can connect with the heart and spirit of the film just so brilliantly and take the whole thing up to a whole other level. And Paul McCartney's score was perfect. And The Family Way was set up in the north of England. And so which of course he knew very well, being a Liverpudlian, although it was actually, the film was Lancashire. But in that part of England, brass bands are traditional. Lots of brass and trumpets and trombones and all that kind of thing. And he used that in the movie, and it just gave such a marvelous feeling of reality and connection to that place and those people.
I love that film, and I've had that soundtrack album, you know, for years as well, alongside my Hayley Mills 45. So you really had a recording career, because this was your second hit single. You already had Let's Get Together. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Was your first hit? So, I mean, you were really had a little recording star. What was it like to be a recording star?
Well, it was really, honestly, let's face it, Gary, it was a bit of a joke, because I really, I was the last person. I was the last person to consider myself a singer. It all started because I had to sing the 23rd Psalm in Tiger Bay.
And you sing it so beautifully.
Well, you know, it was just a child singing. I did manage to sing in tune, and I wasn't tone deaf or anything like that, but I always loved it, loved singing, and I wasn't self-conscious about it. But the recording career, as you put it, was really because of Let's Get Together in the Parent Trap, which was a gimmick. And everybody, myself included, was astonished when it was picked up and people liked it. They thought it was fun, you know, and it did terribly well. I mean, it got to be number one in Hawaii. They know what's what in Hawaii.
Well, you know, speaking of Paul McCartney, I mean, that was released at the, you know, at the height of the Beatles, and here you had a hit single right up there with them.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it? It's no sense at all.
Well, I love it. I want to ask you about some of the people that you knew and worked with in and that you talk about in your wonderful book, Forever Young. Such a great book, by the way. I love it. One of the people, legendary people that you encountered was Ub Iwerks, who was an animator who was at one time Disney's partner and created Mickey Mouse. He's literally the hand that drew Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
And he was, I assume that he was the one who helped make two Hayley Mills in.
He was hugely instrumental in creating that split screen in Parent Trap. So although he was an extremely talented animator, a drawer.
Yeah.
He was a good drawer. He you know, had other talents, as obviously, and that split screen was quite innovative. I mean, it was I don't think they'd seen anything like that before. And I got a lot of letters to the two of us. People thought there were two of me,
yes.
Which was a tremendous compliment, because the contrast between the two girls got very kind of muddy during the film because they were switching roles and all that. And I have to admit, I got quite confused who I was and what accent I was supposed to have at that particular time.
I notice in a lot of your films, you know, just like now, you're British, and there's no explanation for you being British in your films. You just simply are. I mean, you're.
Well, I'm sorry to hear you say that, Gary, because I was supposed to be American in the parent part, but I obviously didn't convince you at all.
No, I'd say no, but oh well. And I love The Parent Trap, and I after I read your book, I watched it again, and it wasn't like I didn't remember it, because I really remembered it. I remembered it, and it was really wonderful to see it again. And I had visited it again over the years a few times, because it's one of my favorite pictures. And one of the things I love about The Parent Trap and Pollyanna and all the films that you made at Disney is there's these wonderful character actors from the 1930s and 40s who show up in your picture. And I love them all, like Charlie Ruggles, who was one of my favorite actors.
And he's a
delightful comedian. And you have a scene where you press your face into him and you make a memory by smelling his coat. And I absolutely tear up when that scene occurs. It's such a beautiful scene. And I love him. What, was he a funny guy? Was he nice?
Yes, really sweet, very warm and sweet. And always, you know, there was always a feeling laughter was very close to the surface. And also people like Kathleen Nesbitt, who is a great star on the English stage and such a glamorous, beautiful old lady. And Una Merkel, who had a...
Oh, Una Merkel, love her.
In films, you know, she was a
comedian. She was in The Bank, Dick.
She'd work with just everybody you could imagine. And Leo Carroll, who played the minister in Parent Trap, was so good. You couldn't take your eyes off me. He was so funny and so naughty. And then you've got Maureen O'Hara. I mean, you know, so I was, and Brian Keith, they were perfect together. So I was surrounded by these great actors with so much experience. And, you know, I just had to learn my lines, really, and not bump into the furniture, because they carried the film.
Most comedies, and especially ones that are aimed at kids, are like 90 minutes or 88 minutes. But The Parent Trap is like 2 hours and 5 minutes or something. They were really big features. I remember seeing it at the theater when I was a kid. And they still hold up. I mean, The Parent Trap particularly. It's a really great film. It's a classic.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I agree, absolutely. And David Swift wrote the script and directed it. David Swift did the adaptation for Pollyanna and directed it. And although the other films that I did for Disney, you know, were fun and good and enjoyable and all that, for me, those two really stand out. Although that Darn Cat was a good movie too, I think.
Particularly That Darn Cat is hilariously funny.
It is a funny film. Yeah.
I don't know how they did it, but I mean, Disney, I guess they can do anything. But the cat, you know, is just hilarious. I don't know.
I hate to blow them.
They had 40 cats.
It wasn't just one cat. I'm sorry. It was five.
Oh, five. And were there people off stage that were, you know, telling the cat what to do and giving them the
answers? Yes, yes. Oh, goodness me, yes. And each cat had his, or maybe it was her, particular trick, particular talent. But they were all extremely heavy. They were all overweight and ornery. they dug their nails, their claws in at the slightest opportunity. But they were remarkable. So every cat had to have a makeup, you know, so that they all looked the same.
They had a cat makeup person.
Yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we are talking this week with movie star Hayley Mills. She's just written a memoir called Forever Young, and she was a movie star since she was a little girl, appearing in Walt Disney classics like Pollyanna, The Parent Trap, and That Darn Cat.
You know, I mentioned to you that I teach film appreciation, and my students, I mean, there's so many, you know, great, important filmmakers from the 20s and 30s and 40s that they've never heard of. They've never heard of Cecil B. DeMille or Frank Capra or whatever, but they all know Walt Disney. That's a name that everybody, a filmmaker who started his career in the 20s and who died, you know, in the 60s, and yet everybody knows his name and his films. That's a remarkable achievement. And you knew him.
I knew him very well and loved him very much. And of course, you know, Walt the man died far too young, far too soon. But his legacy, his genius continues at Disneyland and all those wonderful, wonderful early animated movies. You know, and of course, you know, the Disney Channel, and the name Walt Disney is still very much in the forefront of all our awareness. It's amazing how it's grown. I often wonder what he would feel, what he'd think about how his name and brand and, you know, brainchild and baby and creation, whatever you like to call it, how it's evolved and what he would think about it. Because when I first met him and worked at the studios, they were, compared to other studios at that time, small. You know, it was easy to, you know, steal the messenger boy's bicycle and cycle around the studios and go and see what was going on and wander around the lot.
Wow.
There weren't a lot of them. There was a Western set, and there was another sort of like 1800 set of you know, urban, and there was a feeling that everyone knew what was going on, and everyone knew each other, and that Walt knew everybody, and he was very much a part of every day. He didn't stay up in his office. He came down almost every day and went onto the set and had a look. And I often used to see him behind the camera, behind a light.
So were there a lot of films in production at the studio, or did they just kind of focus on one picture at a time there?
There may have been another one. There was the Mickey Mouse Club, of course.
Oh, yeah.
That was going on. A couple. I'm ashamed I can't tell you exactly which one it was. But, you know, and then, of course, tremendous amount of animation going on. Busy, busy in the animation building.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just live action. It was such a mixture. And then you've got Disneyland. You know, he was very involved with Disneyland, as you can imagine. Yeah. And I'm sure you know, and everybody knows, the story of Walt. He had a huge map on the wall of his outer office of Disneyland, and he would study it. And he would go, oh, that's rather a long walk from Pirates of the Caribbean to the whatever, Peter Pan ride, my favorite, by the way. And that's rather a long walk without anywhere to sit down and without a loo. He was very concerned that there was always a loo in the right place. And I used to think, that's so sweet of Walt Disney to worry about things like loos. But, you know, he was that connected to it. And, you know, he had this wonderful little apartment at Disneyland, on top of the fire station. It was tiny, and it was very funky. It was decorated like a, you know, a little sort of a little salon in the Wild West, with rocking chairs and baubles on the lamps, and he would go and and be incognito, and nobody would know that he was there, and he would observe what was going on. You know, he was, there was a, I think one of the things that attracted me to him so much was this childlike quality.
Yeah, well, you talked about going to Disneyland with him and that you got to go on all the rides without standing in any lines. I was very jealous.
Yeah, I know. That was a bit embarrassing. And then
I was probably standing in that line at the Matterhorn when you took cuts.
I know. And this guy, just this young guy with a you know, Disneyland uniform, saw us. We'd gone in through a side gate. And he came tearing up and said, hey, who do you think you are, Walt Disney? And we all held our breath, and we all turned to him and said in a very small voice, well, yes, as a matter of fact, I am. And I'll never forget the look on the man's face. He just, he tripped and he fell into the geraniums. It was...
What about Marie Chevalier? You worked and sang with Marie Chevalier. What an incredible thing.
I know. What a darling. He really, really was a darling. You know, simple and genuine. All these amazing people that I've worked with, these huge stars and Oscar winners, you know, and there was our child. And they were all so down to earth and genuine and sweet, helpful.
I want to talk a little bit about this marvelous book that you wrote. And what I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised that you're such a marvelous writer. And there's no co-author. You wrote the book yourself.
I did, but it would be a miscarriage of justice if I didn't include my son Crispian, my eldest son Crispian, because he made it possible. He was my guide and my mentor, and our process was that we sat down once I decided to do it. We sat down and we talked about what the book was going to cover. And it was then I decided that, and we decided together that it wasn't, it was just going to end when my children were born. And he gave me the dramatic structure, which is obviously vital to it being readable. And I learned so much working with Crispian. He is a screenwriter and made a couple of movies. He's a writer. He's a musician. He's written many songs. He has a wonderful band called Kula Shaker, which have been, you know, had some, you know, some very successful hits.
Absolutely.
So he, although I wrote it, we discussed what I was going to write. And, you know, I wanted him to have credit on the book. And he said, no, I don't. He said, it would look like it's been ghostwritten or something, and you've written it, and it wouldn't be right. So I always explain the process and how we work together. You know, and it was a wonderful thing to work with my son.
Well, there's a lot of things that you put in this book. It's not just like a show business. This, I made this movie and then this movie, but I mean, you really expertly weave your personal life and your coming of age story into this book. And there's a lot of things that you say that I would think, you know, it's one thing to write them, but it's another thing to then put this book out here into the world. And now I know these things, and you've done an audiobook where you say the things out loud. Well, what was that like? And is there a feeling of, I'm not embarrassment, but here you are saying some very intimate things. Is it comfortable?
Yeah. Sometimes it took me quite a long time to decide what it was I wanted, how much I wanted to say, and then how would I write certain things. I didn't want to invade people's privacy. I didn't feel I had the right to do that. I didn't want to do that. And of course, there are some things that put a bit of a, you know, made it a little bit more tricky, was because I was working with my son. And so it was a matter of finding the boundaries and how far I wanted to go without being coy and without being, I didn't want to write a sort of kiss and tell thing or anything like that. But at the same time, I wanted to be honest. So it was finding that kind of that middle road where people didn't feel cheated. And, you know, you have to, leave a certain amount up to the reader's imagination.
Well, you succeed, because not only did I laugh out loud several times, but I also was quite touched, and it brought back fine memories, but also made me think about things like, you know, when we're kids, we think of our parents as adults, and that they are the ones that make the decisions. And it's not until we kind of get into their age, and as we start to get older, and we think about, well, gosh, I don't think of myself as being particularly mature when I was 35 or whatever. And so we kind of examine what our parents, the decisions our parents made. And that happens in your book. And so I have two questions about it. When you were raising your own children, did you think to yourself about the way you were raised and think, you know, I don't want to do that. You know, I want to make sure that I'm not doing things that on reflection my parents did that they might not have, shouldn't have done.
Well, I think, you know, like everybody, our parents are, as you say, you know, they are the grown-ups, and for a while they can do no wrong. They're the gods on the top of the mountain. And I adored my parents, and both of them. And they had very busy lives, and my mother was a writer, and she was always in her mind, she was with what she was writing. She wasn't a particularly hands-on mum, but she was a wonderful person. She was an entertaining, unique, witty person. And I didn't, you know, as far as I was concerned, she was the perfect mother. But then, like lots of kids, we meet other adults and we think, oh, I like her. She's a good mum. He's a good dad. And we take bits, don't we, from the people around us. And so when I was bringing up my kids, I wanted to be much more hands-on. I wanted to be the cook. I wanted to be the one giving them their bath. I wanted to be the one, you know, doing all those things. So I did, up to a point, but I began to realize how difficult it is to do all those things and have a career.
Yeah.
Which, of course, I had to do. I never was able to just sit around and,
not work. You've kept working your entire life.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm thinking particularly about, I think, the sort of the tip of the iceberg in your story with your parents is when they weren't sure whether or not to let you sign your 7-year contract with Disney, because 7 years is a long time in the life of a 13-year-old kid.
And I like that.
and the decision was influenced by the Swiss Family Robinson.
Yes.
the fact that Disney offered that film to your father was the thing that said, oh, well, all right, then Haley can come.
Well, there's a backstory to that. There's a backstory. And I didn't know this particular story until I went through my boxes in the archives a few years ago when I went to Disney Studios. And, you know, initially it was a 7-year contract and that was rejected. That was just too much for them to take on board. And of course, from 13, 7 years, I mean, I'm nearly 20. So the changes, they couldn't possibly know what I was going to want to do and how I was going to grow or if I even wanted to act anymore. That, you know, it was a very, very difficult decision for them. So they walked away from that. And then it was a 5-year contract with the offer of playing the father in Swiss Family Robbins. And so, as I say in the book, it was, Disney made an offer that it was very difficult for either of us to refuse.
So when you think back about that now, I mean, I'm sure you're happy that you worked at Disney and that you made those films. And maybe you think you should have stayed at Disney longer. But how did it feel to see, oh, it was this thing that made my father decide, a self-serving, if not selfish, thing?
Well, of course, as I said, I didn't know that until I was a very grown-up person. I could understand it. I could understand it, absolutely. And I was quite glad, actually, that the offer that had come through for me had also produced an opportunity for my dad. I was glad about that. And we all had a lovely time when we went to Tobago where they were filming it.
So, oh, it's another movie that I love. And
yeah.
Yeah, and it's another immortal film. And for a long time, for a very long time, it was even a ride at Disneyland.
Yeah. Well, that's this fantastic, you know, the tree.
Yeah.
That is the Swiss now family. It's, Robinson
now
tree.
It's the Tarzan tree house, unfortunately.
For oh, me. No, is it really?
Yes,
oh, that's not right.
No, they took it away.
Oh, that's terrible.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we are talking this week with movie star Haley Mills. In addition to writing a brand new memoir called Forever Young, Haley Mills was a star as a child in Walt Disney pictures like The Parent Trap and That Darn Cat.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your family. You guys had very bizarre nicknames. How did you have such strange nicknames in your family?
Oh, I know. It's really embarrassing. I don't know. I don't know, Gary. I think, I was a weird little, funny little child. And, it was affectionate. I was called Bags, Bagwash. I don't know why.
Does anybody still call you that? Does your sister still call you that?
Well, only if she's being, I don't know. No, not really. Nobody does, actually. Any more than they call my brother Jonathan Nooney. You know, childhood names. Nooney, he came up with, because he was one of those little children who didn't talk for a long time. And then when he was asked what his name was, he said, Nooney. He said, oh, really? He said, no one had ever heard that before. No, I managed to get Bagwash knocked on the head when I was about 16, because when I was struggling to convince everybody I was grown up at cocktail parties, it really was galling to have my father call across the room, Bagwash, shall we go? Are you ready to go, Bagwash?
And
what was your childhood nickname?
I was lucky if my parents knew my name at all.
Oh.
I wanted a nickname. I would like see the kids in the movies and think, how come I'm not Skip or something? But no, I never was.
Yeah.
Like that kid, who I can't remember now what he's called. The boy who's the surfer boy who you go to the drive-in with in That Darn Cat. I wanted to be that kid.
Yeah. He was great.
So funny.
Oh, I love him. Tom Lowell.
Yeah. I mean, he sees that the mystery for those of you who don't remember That Darn Cat has to do with a woman who's being held captive, and she puts her gold watch on this cat's neck, and the boy is the first to discover the watch, and he sees the watch on the cat's neck, and he goes, 11:15, man, I gotta get to sleep.
That's right. What about you? Did you identify with him?
Yeah, well, he was funny. And he liked surfing. Speaking of that, you went on a date with George Harrison. Now, I mean, I was a huge Beatle maniac.
Yes.
And you went on a date with George at the height of Beatlemania.
I know, in the middle of it all. I know. I still can't quite get over it. I did write about that experience in my journal, absolutely minute by minute. I wrote it all down. That's why I have such perfect recall of that experience to put in the book, because and this is this wonderful thing about writing the book, is that I could relive all those experiences. When you get to my age, there aren't very many people who want to sit around listening to you to tell your stories.
I want to. I desperately want to. In fact, I was thinking in your book about, because you do give us, and we get to travel into your journals. Not only do you mention them, but you give us excerpts from your journals, and it's a real wonderful thing to do. And some of the things you talk about in your book, you talk about some of the things that you've lost over the years, like this necklace, this bracelet that was given to you. And you think, oh, that's tragic that those things were lost. But how marvelous that nobody took your journals. Those are the things that really are irreplaceable.
Yes, I know. And they traveled with me all over, everywhere I went. And there was one time when I left one of them in a hotel room somewhere, and I was in such a panic, mercifully it was recovered and sent back to me. But
do you think you kept journals because your mother was a writer, or why did you keep journals?
Well, I was given my first journal when I was just turned 13. I was just about to embark upon a flight across the Atlantic to go to Hollywood to do Pollyanna. And it was a lovely thing. It was a red leather book with the gold edged pages. And it was written, My Trip Abroad. And all those empty pages I found so fascinating. So I started writing it. And then when I was filming Pollyanna, I got a bit too busy. So my mother started putting in the names of people that I met, because she thought that would be nice to remember. So she put some things in, and then it obviously triggered it triggered an interest and a need. Certainly when I got to be 14, I discovered it becomes your secret private friend, to be able to write everything down and hope, that nobody, it's not for anybody else, it's just for you, and to help clear your mind and understand things a bit more clearly. So I really started getting connected to it when I was 14, and then very definitely by the time I was 15. And I loved writing. I loved describing things. I loved describing things, and you know, people's description of things can be a bit boring. But, you know, so I guess, yes, my mother was a writer and I loved her writing. I'm very, very inspired by her writing. I liked the way she looked at life and the kind of things she wrote. You know, she wrote the book of Whistle Down the Wind, which was a beautiful story about children who find a ragged old man, not so old actually, but a ragged man in their barn. And they think he's Jesus and they hide him and they look after him. And, you know, it's a very spiritual book, beautifully written. And her autobiography is beautifully written. So when I came to write this book, I had her autobiography and my father's autobiography, which was just like my father, funny, lovely stories about the business and about people, but not that much about what was going on inside him. And that really, I love stories and funny stories, but that wasn't ever my big thing. Whereas my mother wrote more about her feelings. That interested me.
I can see how, you know, when you said that you were going to write this book, that you would want to focus on the years that I think most people remember you for, and that people would be most interested in. And also it's your coming of age and all that. But now that you've shown us your talents as a writer, will you do another volume of memoir?
I don't know. This was much harder and it took much longer than I thought it would. Actually, in a way, I'm surprised I finished it at all. It was lucky, really, that it was during the pandemic, the initial lockdown, and there we all were incarcerated. And there's nothing else to do, nowhere to go, no people to see. So that was actually rather good timing for me. And but as far as, I don't know, honestly, Gary, it would have to be very different. You see, the thing about this that made me feel it was actually worth doing was that my experiences of trying to grow up are really just the same as everybody else's, except the circumstances were different. But the circumstances were just an addition. They were just an additional, you know, obstacle or challenge, if you like. But everybody struggles with that extremely difficult and sometimes terrifying bridge between childhood and adolescence, where you really don't know who you're going to be and if you're going to be any good and if anyone's going to like you. And then you know, I started putting on weight, getting spots and getting terribly shy, and knew that I was being a big disappointment to people because I couldn't talk to people at parties. And, you know, everybody has those struggles. I mean, and I think we spend our whole life really coming to terms with the effect that our childhood had upon us and has upon us as adults.
Yes, I think we all do. And that's what makes this book so wonderful. I mean, it was really, I just loved it. And it was like a huge disappointment when I got to the end because I was done. And I go, oh no, it's over. So then, I had to watch have a little Hayley Mills Film Festival. <'Cause there's work. laughs> Well, it was beautifully done. The book is called Forever Young and the author, Hayley Mills. The great Hayley Mills, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you very, very much. Take care of yourself.
Joining me now is educator and children's book author Deborah Westgate Silva. Her new book is called Daisies Near Catastrophe. Deborah Westgate Silva, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's a scary book. I mean, it's fine for kids, but I found it frightening. I'm very afraid of my cat going outside and getting lost. It's a beautiful book. Tell me a little bit about the illustrator.
Yes, so the illustrator is from Indonesia, and we had connected online, and I loved his style. I loved the way he captured animals' expressions, and I think he did an amazing job and made the illustrations really fun for kids.
And what's the illustrator's name?
Joris Handoko. And he actually, I mean, he had probably a bigger job than most illustrators do because the illustrations tell part of the story that is not in the words of the story. So
Yeah.
he really was kind of doing two things at once, and I think he did phenomenal.
And did you outline those clues that you wanted in the illustrations?
Yes. So he had the back matter. Which outlines the actual rescue efforts when Daisy the kitten went missing, and then I had notes for each page spread as well, and then but I wanted him to have creative liberty as well, and we it was a lot of fun actually. We did some back and forth on different aspects of it, and
Well, it's a very beautiful book. I really enjoyed it. And I want you to tell us a little bit about the origin story of it and the plot. I mean, it's I guess it's when I talk to authors of fiction, although this book is only slightly fiction, I never want to give away their story, but I guess in this case it's a children's book that parents will buy for their children, and their children are probably not listening to from the bookshelf right now. So it's okay to reveal as much as you want of the plot.
okay, great. So Daisy's Near Catastrophe is my new children's picture book. It just released last month, and it's based on my nephew's kitten Daisy, who really can open doors. When the family went on vacation, they boarded their pets, and the dogs went to one kennel, and Daisy went to a kennel because the dog's kennel didn't take cats. In the first night she was in her kennel, she escaped. So the kennel owners felt terrible and hired a canine tracker, a dog that is trained to find missing pets. And I had never heard of this before, and I thought it was fascinating. I thought kids would think it was fascinating too. And even though I knew there was great story potential from the beginning, I also knew I could never write the story if the real Daisy didn't have a happy ending.
No, that
And
would be bad.
thanks to Harper, the German Shepherd, and her handler, Sam, Daisy was reunited with her family.
That is such a fascinating thing. I mean, we do see missing pet flyers all the time, which are featured in your story too. And we always think, oh, they're never going to see that creature again. But the fact that is actually like a unit that is out trying to find these missing animals is pretty amazing.
Yes. So it and it's really an amazing process. I couldn't picture how it would happen and how the dog wouldn't scare the kitten further into hiding. And then I had this vision of, the dog carrying the kitten back like a wild animal carries its young, and that was not at all how it happened. They brought Hopper, the German Shepherd, to the window that Daisy had escaped from. They gave her blanket so she could learn her scent, and then she began to track her. And she led the handler into this kind of densely wooded area not too far from the kennel. And then Hopper just sat and refused to move. And that's how Sam knew Daisy's close by, but because it was so densely wooded, she couldn't actually see Daisy. So she set up food because she knows if the missing pet eats from the food source she sets up, they'll return there. She set up cameras. It's a weatherproof camera that belts around a tree. And then as soon as she had Daisy on camera eating from the food source, she set up a trap. So
Wow.
all of those rescue efforts are depicted in the illustrations.
Yeah, and very well, and it's an exciting little story. And I want to ask you about the language. I mean, even the word catastrophe, it seems to be a vocabulary word. I mean, what age group is this intended for? I mean, I'm not going to say my age, but it's perfect for me. But what about?
So it's market. I love this question because you've just given me an opportunity to do my literacy spiel. Okay. So it's marketed for ages 4 to 8 or 4 to 9. But I've spent my entire career working with books and children and literacy, whether it was teaching or grant writing or different boards that I'm on. And just the amount of research that supports the benefits of reading to children from birth in the first three years of life is when the most brain growth and development happens. And reading aloud to children has been shown to activate parts of the brain and to build those foundations for literacy and language and to even develop social emotional reading skills. So I always like to say, for any picture book at all, a child is never too young to hear it.
And never too old as well. So
I agree with that. I agree with that as well.
So do you have to, as a children's book author, this isn't your first book. I know you had a very successful previous book. How do you go about choosing your vocabulary, your sentence length? Do you work with an editor, or is this an instinctual thing, or are there rules? Is there, they send you a guidebook? How does it work?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. So I always like to think that I want it to be accessible to readers, but I also want to stretch them. And I think that that's a fine line. And I also think about, you know, things like alliteration or rhyme or, you know, the things that make it more poetic. So I'm not sure there's a hard and fast rule there. This particular story, I worked, you know, in different writing classes and workshops. I had critique partners. I worked with some editors, and I worked with the agent that I was working with at the time. So it went through a lot of revisions and feedback processes.
Well, that's very interesting. So approximately how many drafts of Daisy?
Oh, my gosh. I can't even answer that question because I probably could answer the question, actually, because I'm always afraid to delete. So I just keep resaving using new file names. So I probably could, but it would take me a while to count them all. But it was about a 2-year process because I experimented with different points of view and different, you know, narrative structures. And then sometimes you just need to step away so that you can approach it again with a fresh perspective. So it was actually a 2-year process to write, you know, such a small children's
book. Yeah, that's right. It's not that many words, but the words are very well chosen. So they're like polished little, each one is like a little gem, each little word, even each little sentence in its place. That's really fascinating. I suppose it's the same as if you're writing a 300-page novel or you're writing this little children's book.
Yeah, so a children's book typically is 32 pages long, and that includes your title page, copyright, dedication, all of that. So you have a limited number of page spreads, and the industry trend right now is a word count range of 200 to 800 words is kind of considered on the heavy side in today's standards. So you try to fit all of those things, you know, character arc and narrative structure and all that within a very limited word count and page spread. So yeah, every word does count. I was just gonna say, a lot of times it's a matter of going through it and saying, okay, like, what are the unnecessary words here, and when I take them out, does it still sound nice? And reading it aloud to hear how it sounds, and asking somebody else to read it aloud so you can hear it with fresh ears. And
now you have children. How old are your children?
They're grown now. They are out of college and one is out of the house.
Well, you
So,
could try it out on them. They're too old.
no, I have nieces and nephews though that I try, and I have a classroom that they were willing to hear it before it was actually a book. So that was a lot of fun to get feedback. That was a group of first and second graders.
Oh, that's nice. And now the obviously that you had to polish that 2-year text before you sent anything to your illustrator.
Yes, it had to be pretty final at that point. Although it was interesting because when I started to see the illustrations, sometimes that helped me to look at it with new eyes and say, "Oh, that's already there. I don't actually need these couple of words." So I did have the opportunity to tweak a few things between the illustrations and the graphic design process.
I like how you made a little game of it in the very end of your book, saying, which would encourage kids to read the book again. Can you find the clues of these techniques of finding Daisy that I'm talking about in your little afterword, which I think is great. And the clues are there. Now, you used to write for Highlights magazine. They used to have those hidden pictures.
No, I didn't do the hidden pictures, but I did have a couple stories published and purchased by Highlights Children's Magazine.
Yeah, no one's ever read anything in there. They only look at those hidden pictures. Sorry, nobody read your. No, I'm sure.
Actually, one of the stories I wrote for them is now a test on one of the New York State I think it's grade 3 reading tests.
Wow.
Yeah, that was kind
Amazing.
of I was surprised when I found that out.
Yeah, whenever I go to the dentist, I still like to find those hidden pictures. I don't have any actual teeth left, but yet I still go to the
You
desk
go just for the
just to
magazines.
find those hidden pictures in there. And you have a previous book. Tell us a little bit about that.
I do. So Bethlehem Barn is a children's book for the Christian market. It's a retelling of the nativity story from the animal's perspective. So apparently I have a thing for animals. That was a surprise to me. But I had heard that there's an ancient legend that for 1 hour every year on Christmas Eve, animals are given the gift of speech. And I just thought, what a fun way to tell the Christmas story in hopefully a way that kids would want to hear it again and again, because when something makes them laugh, that they generally want to hear it more than once. So that was a lot of fun to write as well.
Well, all the greatest children's books are written about animals, I believe.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Well, the book again is called Daisies Near Catastrophe, and it's based on a true story. So if you ever lose your pet, this would be a good resource to check out how to get your pet back. And the author, my guest, Deborah Westgate Silva, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. It's been a pleasure.
It has been. Thank you. I appreciate you inviting me here.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.